morning. I am so glad that you guys are here. When I looked at the brochure at last count, I think there were 17 sessions going on during this time slot, so I am just thrilled that you guys would come and take the time and listen and discuss a topic that I hope is going to be very timely and informative. My name is Laura Locke Estes. I'm a student of early church history at Abilene Christian University. Most of the time I study early Christian and Muslim interaction in the first couple of centuries after Islam first emerged as a religion. And I imagine that as you were scanning the schedule, something about this class title caught your eye. Maybe it was the phrase, encountering Islam. It seems that you can't pick up a newspaper, or if you're part of the millennial generation like me, scan through your Twitter newsfeed without a story about Christian-Muslim interaction or terrorism or Islamic radicalism popping up. Recent events, everything from bombings and plane hijackings to the rapid influx of refugees fleeing west, some of whom are Muslim and all of whom are fleeing those same terrorists, has brought Islam to the forefront of the American consciousness in an unprecedented way. Muslims are our neighbors, Muslims are our co-workers, and sometimes Muslims seem to be our enemies. And as Christians, particularly those of us who also happen to be American, some of us aren't quite sure what to do with a religion that seems to us so strange and foreign and threatening in many ways. Now, on the other hand, maybe you were intrigued by the tagline, Lessons from the Restoration or Stone Campbell Movement. And if you are one of those, God bless you. That means that I have found my kind of people, some fellow history buffs. Now, I do have to confess, I am not a Stone Campbell specialist, although I have spent all 26 years of my life embedded in churches of that tradition. No, I spend my time holed up with old manuscripts, reading dead languages, and researching obscure Christian texts written about the time that Islam was emerging. But even I, every once in a while, I get lured in by that seductive siren song of a topic that seems to be modern and contemporary, and even that buzzword we love so much, relevant. And so I chose to do something more modern, so I went to the mid-1800s. I'm trying. I really am. We're getting closer. So that's the starting point for this class. Fulfilling that lessons from the Stone Campbell movement part of the bargain, I'm going to talk a little bit about a particular historical interaction between Christians and Muslims that I've spent some time studying, and that's the Barclay mission to Jerusalem that we sent in the mid-19th century. But I don't want to stop there. I want to use that window into our tradition's past as a jumping-off point for discussion about how we as modern, contemporary, relevant 21st century Christians can better engage with our Muslim neighbors. Or even if you're sitting there thinking, well, I'm not sure that I actually have any Muslim neighbors, well, hopefully we can talk about how when Islam inevitably comes up as a topic of conversation in the news, at school, around the water cooler, in our congregations, and we can talk about Islam in a way that befits our Christian witness, that is humble, that is gracious, that is true. Now, I know that this is a really tall task for a 45-minute class, and I don't pretend to think that we could possibly comprehensively cover a topic of that importance in this sort of time frame, but I do still, nonetheless, want to leave a chunk of time at the end for questions. I'll do my best to answer, and I invite all of you to share your experience and your wisdom as well during that time. Now, on to the Barclay mission. Missions have been a vital part of the Stone Campbell ethos since our inception. We had this grand vision of restoring the first century church, not only here at home in America, but throughout all of the world. So, in fact, one of the earliest formal collective activities that our tradition undertook was the formation of the American Christian Missionary Society, or the ACMS. This happened back in 1849. And just 1 year after the ACMS was founded, we had already secured the funding and sent off our first foreign missionaries. These were the Barclays. Now, the Barclay family was sent to Jerusalem, which is kind of an interesting choice, but this was not an accident. It seemed really fitting to our forefathers and foremothers to begin their task of restoring the church in the city where it first began, because we are Acts 2 sorts of people, after all. Now, some people had an additional motive for choosing Jerusalem. Without going down the rabbit hole of our tradition's early millennial impulses and origins, which in recent times we've kind of had a tendency to downplay, What you need to know is that many Christians interpreted Paul's letter to the Romans, particularly that part where he talks about how all Israel will be saved. They thought that that meant that the conversion of the Jewish people was a prerequisite for Christ's second coming. So in other words, some Stone Campbell leaders sent the Barclays to Jerusalem because they wanted them to convert the Jews so that Jesus could come back. Now, Jerusalem had long ceased to be a strictly Jewish city. At the time of the Barclay mission, it was under the rule of the Ottoman Turks, and more than half of the city's inhabitants were Muslims. And so, although the Barclays began their mission expecting to evangelize Jews, they found that many of their potential converts were actually followers of Islam. Now, if the Barclays knew little about contemporary Judaism, they certainly knew little about 19th century Islam. And it's really easy from our position of privilege of having 150 plus years of missions experience and missiological reflection to scoff at the naivete of the Barclays and the ACMS. After all, there was no survey trip, there was no language school, they just had some minimal contacts. And yet you really have to admire the conviction and the gumption of people who would make a 7-month journey, including a 10-month ride on horseback to the backwater town of Jerusalem, all to preach the good news. But also, as you might expect, the Barclay mission faced its fair share of challenges and shortcomings, particularly in its efforts to reach Muslims. I want to highlight some of these because I think that many of the challenges and shortcomings that the Barclays faced are the same sorts of challenges and shortcomings that we face when we try to talk to Muslims and about Islam today. So first, in Barclay's letters, there's a general lack of understanding or sometimes even outright misunderstanding about the teachings and practices of Islam. He sometimes reports incorrect information, and he often buys into stereotypes about Muslims and about Islamic culture in general. Second, he has a tendency to explain Islam's distinctive features in terms of Christianity. So, for example, Islam and Christianity share a lot of the same prophetic figures, so Elijah, Moses, even Jesus. We'll talk about this later. Barclay exhibits a tendency to describe these shared figures, and particularly the differences between them, as examples of Islam's corruption or misunderstanding of Christianity or Judaism. As another example, Islam's conception of a very physical, sensual paradise is seen by Barclay as being derivative of Christianity's conception of a more spiritualized heaven. And then third, I think that this is tied really closely to the first two, but it is distinctive. Barclay very quickly adopts a polemical stance when he is discussing religion with Muslims. That is, he spends very little time understanding what might be compelling or attractive about Islam to Muslims, why they would have wholeheartedly committed to their faith, and he moves immediately to try and convince listeners of the truth of Christianity and the falsehood of Islam. So as a result, his arguments sometimes ring really empty to Muslim ears because he doesn't understand his audience, their motives, or their priorities. The Barclay mission is often considered a failure by historians. Very few people were converted to Christianity or to our particular brand of Christianity, and any trace of the congregation that the Barclays established disappeared within just a few years of them returning back to the U.S. They had to come back in 1862, right before the outbreak of the Civil War, because they were losing funding. I think, though, that the way that we judge a mission as a failure is largely dependent on our definition of the word failure. The Barclay mission was an important first step and learning experience for Stone Campbell missions, and it introduced members of our tradition to Islam in a tangible way for what was likely the first ever time. Now let's shift back to the 21st century for a moment. When I first began prepping for this class, I asked several friends and acquaintances and members of my church a simple question. If you were going to a class at a Bible lecture about Islam, what would you hope to hear about? What I found really fascinating was that the answers I received in many ways paralleled the challenges and shortcomings of the Barclay mission. That is, in many ways, Islam is just as new and strange to us as it was to our first intrepid missionaries more than 150 years ago. So here are a few of the responses that I received. I wish that I knew more about Islam in general, its beliefs and its practices. What do Muslims believe? Do Muslims believe that Muhammad is God like we think that Jesus is God? Why do Muslims hate Christians? how do I talk to Muslims about Jesus? And then very similarly, how can I evangelize in a Muslim context? How are Christianity and Islam different? And then sort of the flip side of that, Islam and Christianity and Judaism are all described as Abrahamic faiths. What does that even mean? Do Muslims and Christians worship the same God? Can Christianity and Islam coexist? So throughout these questions, there are a few common themes. So that general lack of understanding of the basic contours of the Islamic faith, a tendency to want to understand and explain Islam in terms of Christianity, and a little more subtle, but I think still present in some of the questions, is the desire to correct perceived errors in Islam and to advocate for Christianity as superior. Now, I think that this impulse is a good one, that we as Christians who are convicted of our faith in Christ Jesus and who believe that the gospel is for all people should want to tell people, including Muslims, about the truth of God the Son who became human. The problem is that our weaknesses in those first two areas, that general lack of understanding and our tendency to describe Islam in terms of Christianity, means that sometimes we aren't particularly effective at evangelization. Now, we could spend an entire semester in a college course talking about Islam, and we'd still only know the basics. I mean, think about Christianity and how many of us have been Christians for decades, and we're still gaining deeper understanding of our own faith. But I'm hoping that I can do in just a few minutes to give you the lowdown, bare bones, quick and dirty intro to Islam 101. So for some of you, this might be a review. For some of you, this might all be new information. I hope that if you have questions as I'm speaking, please write them down so that we can talk about them a little bit at the end here. Now, ideally, you'd be talking to a Muslim about their own faith and not a Christian who simply studies Islam academically. But you're stuck with me, so we're going to do the best that we can. But I would encourage you, if you have Muslim friends or neighbors or coworkers, ask them these questions too, because they might give you a different perspective, although that I hope that at least in the facts, I can be fair and accurate. Now, one thing that I have been convinced of as I have studied Christian and Muslim theology at a graduate level is that the two faiths share a common core of literature and tradition that informs a lot of the ways that we understand God. And I hope that you'll see this throughout the discussion. I'm going to try and highlight this. So let's start at the beginning, which I have heard is a very fine place to start. The location is the Arabian Peninsula. And the time, the late 500s and 600s. We're talking 500-600 years after the time of Christ. There is a man, he's a merchant, and his name is Muhammad. He lives in a major trade city on the Arabian Peninsula called Mecca. Mecca is, as many cities are at the time, also a center of pagan polytheistic worship. There's a place called the Kaaba that's in the center of the city where a variety of idols and objects of worship are kept, and lots of people come so they can worship there. Muhammad is a very religious man, and when he's about 40 years old, he retreats to a cave for a time of intense prayer. During this time of prayer, he believes that the angel Gabriel, it's interesting, you might already recognize a character here. This is the same angel Gabriel that tells Mary that she's going to have a son in Jesus in the Gospel of Luke. So the angel Gabriel appears to Muhammad with a message from God. The core component of this message is that God is one God. There's no one like him. He is the creator. He's eternal. And he is the only one who is worthy of worship. Now, I'm going to use the word God for this one divine being throughout this discussion. You might also know that Muslims use the term Allah when referring to God. This is considered God's name in Islam, but it's also simply the Arabic word for God. So if you were a Christian or a Jew who spoke Arabic, you would also use this word to describe God. So back to Gabriel and Muhammad. This is the first in a series of messages that Muhammad receives throughout his life. The core teaching is always the same. There's one God, only one God. And Muhammad, from the beginning, sees himself as being one in a long line of prophets, messengers, that God has sent to humanity to affirm the central message, that he is one God. So, therefore, Muhammad recognizes Jewish and Christian prophets. He affirms the messages of figures that we would also recognize, figures like Adam and Moses and David and Elijah and even Jesus. Now, Muhammad believes that his message is the same message that those men preached. Now, if Christianity and Judaism in Muhammad's own time differ in their teachings from Islam, that is because over time, the pure message of the prophets has been corrupted or changed. And in fact, this is why God has to keep sending prophets, right, to correct the people and exhort them back to that central belief that God is one. You might be wondering right now, well, where did Muhammad get these ideas about Adam and Moses and Jesus? Where did he even hear these stories? Historians wonder the same thing. This is a matter of great debate in early Islamic studies. If you're a devout Muslim, of course, you believe that Muhammad knows about these figures because he received revelation from God through Gabriel. But it also seems likely from a historical perspective that Muhammad had some sort of interaction with Christians and Jews during his lifetime. And even more than that, that there are certain stories that we would call biblical that were just commonly circulating in Arabia during this time. Muhammad's preaching refers to biblical stories all the time without necessarily outlining the actual narrative. He seems to just assume that his audience is already familiar with these stories. Perhaps they were circulating in the same way that certain fairy tales or bedtime stories circulate now. We all know the basic contours of Little Red Riding Hood or Goldilocks and the Three Bears. Even if we can't remember when we first read or heard those stories, they're just part of our literary consciousness and cultural context. If I talk about something being too hot, and this is too cold, and this one is just right, you immediately bring to mind the entire story of Goldilocks and the Three Bears. I can just say a phrase like that, and you get it. This seems to be how the biblical stories are circulating at this time in Arabia. Back to Muhammad. He returns to his hometown of Mecca after receiving this vision. He's convinced of the truth that there's just one God. But as you can imagine, he receives some pushback from his local Meccan leaders who are staunch polytheists. Remember that the Kaaba is there. It's a city where there's major pilgrimage happening. So although Muhammad begins to collect followers who buy into his idea that there's just one God, they're persecuted, and eventually he and his followers flee to Medina, which is a nearby city on the Arabian Peninsula. There, his movement grows, and a community of Muslims form. Muhammad becomes both a religious and a political leader. This is an arrangement that's quite common in the ancient world, where politics and religion were two sides of the same coin. They're both authorities that are working in tandem together. After some time, Muhammad and his followers conquer Mecca through military power. Now, for Muslims, this is understood as the natural outgrowth of political conflict that had been festering between Medina and Mecca for years. It's not really seen as necessarily a crusade or like an armed religious movement. Again, politics and religious are closely intertwined, so it's hard to parse the two. But this is primarily seen as being a way of protecting the property and the lives of the people of Medina who were being persecuted against these hostile Meccan threats. But there is some sort of religious component, too, because this new community of Muslims sees God as being on their side. They believe that he is the one who is enabling their military success. Now, from that center there in Mecca, a consolidation of Arab tribal powers under Muhammad begins. This is a political process, but again, it does have a religious component. Muhammad is tapping into this shared Arab identity and the concept of a unified Arab state, but this is supported and undergirded by a new shared religious identity as well. The two are bolstering each other. Nonetheless, it's important to note that this forming Arab state is made up of tribes of Arab people who are actually Jewish and Christian, and they're not required to convert to Islam. These fellow monotheistic faiths, which Muhammad calls the people of the book, are not necessarily held as being equal or on the same level as Muslims, but they do share that important core, that belief in one God. And so maybe Muhammad thought that he could correct some misunderstandings by Jews and Christians about God and how to worship him, but they were definitely being held in a different regard than pagan polytheists. Now, as this Arab state grew more powerful and its political influence spread, sometimes peacefully, sometimes through military conquests, at least in the early days of Islam, there's no evidence that conquered peoples, especially Christians and Jews, were forced to convert to Islam. As long as they accepted this new political Arab rule, they were allowed to keep their faith, sometimes with restrictions as to how publicly they could celebrate it, but nonetheless, they were able to keep it. Muhammad dies in 632, just a few years before Muslim power had spread as far north and west as Jerusalem. His preaching was recorded by his followers after his death. And of these, there are two categories. The first is the Quran. This is the divine word that was revealed by Gabriel to Muhammad. So this might be the equivalent of our scriptures, so the Bible. Muslims do have a very strong sense of verbal plenary inspiration. That is, that the Quran is like the very exact word of God who spoke the Arabic tongue. So the precise words. There is another category, though, of recorded preaching and teaching of Muhammad. This is called the Hadith. These are stories about Muhammad, his preaching and his actions. These are not held as being the word of God in the same way that the Quran is, so they're secondary to it, but they're complementary to it as well. They're crucial for Muslim understanding of how they should worship and believe. They kind of round out the teaching of the Quran and tell you how you should live your everyday life as a Muslim. Muhammad is considered what Muslims would call the seal of the prophets. He's the final prophet in that long line of prophets that reaches all the way back to Adam. But no other prophets are going to rise up after him. And the Quran is the final revelation of God. After Muhammad's death, his political and religious leadership is assumed by a man who is known as the Caliph. There are four men who rise as undisputed caliphs after Muhammad's death. All Muslims recognize them. But after that, as often happens in religion and politics, there was some disagreement about who should be leading the Muslim community. Now, this disagreement ends up manifesting itself in the rise of the two major branches of Islam, Shia and Sunni. Unfortunately, I don't have a lot of time to talk to you about the ins and outs of all of that, but I do just want you to be aware that Islam, like Christianity, is made up of different denominations or branches who don't always agree. Nonetheless, there are some basic tenets of Islam that undergird the practice and belief of all Muslims. We mentioned one, that God is one, there's no other God. And as a result of this belief, Muslims are especially troubled by the way that Christians speak about the Trinity. This seems to them to be three gods, not one God. And honestly, we as Christians have a hard time with the Trinity. We spent hundreds of years and dozens of councils arguing about how exactly that worked, and we still haven't quite reached a consensus. So it's really no surprise that Muslims would have a hard time with this too. In many ways, their teaching about God has really streamlined monotheism to a very basic, understandable way that has less debate involved. Another central tenet of Islam that I want to point out is the idea of submission. This is actually the root word behind Islam. It's the meaning of the word is submission, and if you are a Muslim, it's someone who submits. This is central to Muslim identity, this deep sense of obligation of humankind to submit to God and his will. I think this is something that Christians can get on board with, too. Now, as far as practices go, there are five pillars of Islam. And there's just something about the number five. Like, we Church of Christers have our like five acts of worship and our five steps of salvation, and Muslims have the five pillars of Islam, which are as follows. The first is the profession of faith. There is no God but God, and Muhammad is his prophet. This is the basic creed that a person must submit to in order to be considered a Muslim. So if someone were to convert to Islam, they would recite this in front of the congregation as a sign of joining the community. The second pillar is prayer. Muslims pray five times daily to God. This is considered one of the main ways that Muslims establish a direct or a personal relationship with God. On Fridays, many Muslims meet for communal prayer and to hear a sermon that is preached to them from the Quran. The third pillar is almsgiving. There's a really strong sense of obligation to be charitable and hospitable to the poor in Islam. The fourth pillar is fasting during the month of Ramadan. We might liken this to Lent, especially the ancient practice of Lent, although Islam requires a stricter form of fasting than most modern Christians engage in. They don't eat anything during daylight hours. They can only eat at night. The fifth pillar is pilgrimage to Mecca for anyone for whom this is financially feasible. This is a way of connecting the faith to its origins in a very tangible way by being in those holy places where the faith first began. In addition to these five pillars, there are a variety of other expectations for Muslims. When I spoke to a friend who is an imam, that's sort of like a priest or a rabbi or a preacher for Muslims, about what he thought were the central values of Islam, he added the following: hospitality, hard work so that one can provide for their family and give generously to the poor. Sobriety and moderation. So, for example, strict Muslims do not drink, and they hold that sexual relationships should be restricted only to marriage. He also mentioned honesty in work and financial matters. So, for example, strict Muslims don't engage in any sort of interest-bearing loans or other financial activities that involve interest because they believe that interest unfairly takes advantage of the poor. So there it is, the quick version of the origins and major beliefs and practices of Islam. Couldn't hope to be comprehensive, but again, feel free to ask questions later if there's something in particular you'd like to know more about. You might have noticed that I spent a lot of time pointing out similarities between Christianity and Islam, and this is because I am convinced that the two faiths share a lot in common, both in their theological foundations, but also in their morality and their practice. I remember growing up in conservative churches of Christ. I didn't dance, I didn't smoke, I didn't drink. And the other students at my high school who really understood that were some of my Muslim classmates because they also didn't dance or smoke or drink. But while I've stressed the similarities between the two faiths, I also want to emphasize that I do believe that there are real, concrete, and important differences between Christianity and Islam. For the record, I am a Christian. I do believe that Christianity offers the best and the fullest picture of God, how he works among humanity, and the sorts of practices that form and shape us into the sort of people that God wants to be. I simply want to point out the similarities because often I think that our conversation with peoples of other faiths start out with the differences, and this inevitably puts us on a playing field where we are pitted against each other and it makes us antagonistic. Instead, I think that we will find that our conversations will be more productive if we lay a foundation of commonality upon which we can all draw when we begin to discuss those differences. Now, on to the differences. A lot of times, we spend a lot of our conversations talking about particularities, that is, the details of our faith and our practice where they disagree. I want to challenge us today, in the time we have left, to think on a more meta level. Here, I'm going to borrow from the work of Mark Heim in particular, his discussion of religious ends. Heim argues that when we speak about religions and pluralism and interfaith dialogue, most of the time we take one of two stances. The first is an exclusivist stance. It says that there is one religious end, so as Christians we might call that religious end salvation, and that there is just one way or means of reaching that religious end. So again, as Christians, we might call this Christianity or the Christian life. Any other way or any other means cannot reach the end of salvation. The second stance is one that's an inclusivist one. It also affirms that there's just one religious end, but it imagines that there are many ways or paths or means to reach this end. So if we're talking about salvation again, an inclusivist stance would say that all religions, Hinduism, Islam, Buddhism, Christianity, are tapping into some sort of greater truth, that we're all taking different paths that ultimately lead to one place, the same religious end. Heim says that these two stances are lacking. The first one, the exclusivist position, fails to account for human religious experience. So that is, it fails to account for the fact that people are convicted by and shaped and transformed by different religions. In other words, it dismisses the reality that Muslims and Buddhists and Christians alike have religious experiences that shape them in very real ways. On the other hand, the second position, the inclusivist one, seems to say that your religion really doesn't matter all that much, that there's nothing distinctive about Christianity or Islam or any other religion because they all end up in the same place anyway. And I think that as Christians, that should make us very uncomfortable. We are convicted that Jesus makes a very real difference, that the things that we do as Christians make a very real difference. So Heim instead argues that there's not just one religious end. That is, different religions do take different paths, and those paths lead to different religious ends. They have different end goals. The beauty of this argument is that it allows us to recognize that our religion, our beliefs, and our practices really do matter. They really do shape us. The things that we do and the things that we believe form us into the people that we are. This view also honors religious experience. It allows you to recognize that other people have real experiences that are shaped by their religion. I think that this also gives us some good tools for evaluating and comparing religions. We don't have to say that all religious ends are equally good or valuable. We can still affirm that the Christian way leads to a particular religious end that is superior to all other religious ends. But it also allows us to recognize that other religions, so for example, Islam, really are shaping their adherents in real tangible ways. They are taking them to particular religious ends. And so what might that religious end be for Muslims? Well, Muslims don't really speak of salvation in the same way that Christians do. They certainly have an idea of paradise and of reward in the afterlife, but that word salvation isn't really part of their vocabulary in the way that it is for us. Instead, I would argue that the religious end of Islam is, as its name suggests, submission. The Muslim way of life, their beliefs, their practices, when properly believed and practiced, form Muslims in such a way that they become exemplars of submission to God. This is a crucial point for understanding and for any productive conversation with Muslims. We must recognize that there are times when our faiths are simply trying to do different things. They're trying to accomplish different ends. What then is the religious end of Christianity? I've already mentioned that it's salvation, and particularly like Haim, I would argue that salvation is, for Christians, a relationship with God, a particular relationship that is mediated through Christ Jesus. If we are to be effective Christian witnesses to our Muslim neighbors, this is the core of our identity. Our beliefs and our practices must bolster this goal, which is attaining relationship with God through Christ. We have to show why this goal is important, why it's the greatest of all religious goals. And once we've done that, I really do think that some of those details, those particulars, those differences between Christianity and Islam are just going to take care of themselves in our conversations. So thank you so much for your attention. I'd really love to spend the last 15 minutes that we have to hear your questions and to just spend some time in discussion. So oops, raise hands. Yes.
Do you know a detailed history of the Barker Mission?
Did you ask if I've written a detailed history?
Do you know of one?
Do I know of one? There's a lot of primary sources that have been put together that you can read, so a lot of his letters that he wrote. There are a couple of articles that I could point you to after class if you're interested to learn more. He did write a book as well, but it's mostly an archaeological book about his time in Jerusalem. So, yes?
On the pillars, I missed three.
Oh, sure. Well, let me make sure that I get them in order. So I'm going to go back real quickly. So you had the confession of faith, the prayer, almsgiving was the third, so giving to the poor.
Okay.
Yes.
We have become friends with a wonderful Islamic couple, mm-hmm. just admirable people. And they are a far cry from what you read about in the newspapers. And yet, we want to introduce salvation, Jesus, into the conversation. What might be a really good starting point?
Yeah. So with this, it's always difficult when you are talking to someone who is a committed member of their faith, right? Like there are real reasons why they are invested in that faith. I think that I would spend some time thinking about what is attractive to you about Christianity, what it is that is compelling to you about Christianity. For me, it's the idea that God would humble himself and become human. That's an idea that's really foreign to Islam. God is very, they really protect the sanctity, the holiness, the highness of God, and they cannot imagine a God who would become human, who would mingle with humankind in that sort of way. But to me, that's one of the beauties of Christianity is that God has this relationship with humans that is that he would be willing to become human himself. So I think finding things like that can be a good starting point.
Ms. Barclay, what are some other major figures in the history of the Restoration Movement in regards to encounters with Islam?
Yeah. Here I might point you to some Stone Campbell specialists. I don't know, like Jamie, do you have any suggestions?
Lee Cantor wrote a really good book.
Okay.
That's one I'm thinking about.
Yeah. I wasn't joking when I said that going to the 1800s is about as modern as I get. I really do spend most of my time in very early Christianity, in like the 600s, 700s, 800s, 900s.
There's a mission to Turkey around 1900, sponsored by the Gospel Advocate. I think it was a gentleman who had gone to the Nashville Bible School, which is now Lipscomb University. He was originally from Turkey. He goes back to Turkey. And actually, there's even a tract related to Islam printed by the Gospel Advocate in that time frame. But there's not a lot.
Yeah, does anybody else have missions that they can think of off the top of their head that might be good resources?
Well, I had the great pleasure of meeting Jared Looney. He's a young man who's doing a mission work up in the New York City area.
Global cities.
What?
Global cities.
Oh, global cities, okay. So, just global cities in general. And his basic thing was, I can just pull up my notes here, just give me a second. But yeah, he dealt with a lot of folks talking about Islam, and one of the things is that the Islamic faith is largely absolutely fascinated with Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they are actually called to study Jesus and his work. So a great place to start would be the Sermon on the Mount.
Hmm.
You know, I mean, it's the, you know, Christianity 101 there. But the other thing is also, it also depends on how much you have interacted with them. You have to understand, these people are deeply religious. They hold their faith in Muhammad to be insanely high. And we kind of all too often treat our own religious experiences as a side thing to the other stuff. Like, we can have entire conversations about a million other things, and then, 6 months in, by the way, are you a Christian? It just kind of comes up. To the Muslim faith, that comes right out. I'm Muslim. Boom. So if you don't talk about it right away, they it's not important. So it can be really hard to start a conversation from there also, because they're like going, well, none of you for 6 months, you never even mentioned Jesus once. What's going on? Why is this coming out of nowhere all of a sudden? So that can kind of cause a little bit of an awkward start there. Yes. But you really got to be really up front with them.
Yes.
I was watching Fox News, and they had the son of one of the ISIS leaders who had become a Christian.
Oh, really?
And he said what impressed him, and impressed his friends about Christianity, is we say to love your enemy and pray for them. And they found this is a unique thought to them, because in the Quran, you kill them. And they were impressed with Jesus taught, you love your enemies, you do good to them, you don't do bad. And so the Muslims that will really have converted from being staunch Muslims were because of Christ's gentleness and his thoughts of how you treat others.
Yeah, I think especially for someone who's maybe coming from a more militant form of Islam, that would be a really attractive component. There is a thing called a common word between us and you that some Muslim leaders issued. It was kind of a call to interfaith discussion, and they actually pulled those two greatest commands, you know, love God and love your neighbor. They said that those were two things that both Christianity and Islam shared, and that was something that we could use as a point of common dialogue. So at least for some Muslims, that's something that they see within their faith already, but there are certainly other forms of Islam where that idea of radical love for neighbor would be really attractive. Yeah?
I don't want to assume this applies to everyone, every Muslim, but I was reading some history on Thomas Jefferson during the power of time, and how they were trying to had no navy at the time, and they had no way to defend themselves. And they were trying to get treaties with some of the countries over there, and they set up all these treaties, and none of them, like, they didn't follow through on any of them. Like, they just lied to them. The Americans thought they were being lied to. And somewhere in the reading, I remember, they said that a Muslim believer, maybe it's just a group or just some certain people, but they believe that if you were basically an infidel, they could lie to you. That was okay. Is that something in the Quran or something that's just made up?
Yeah, there's probably a piece of it that's cultural. I mean, there are some judicial ruling things where, like, the word of a Muslim means more than the word of a non-Muslim, like from a legal standpoint. So it might be something that's drawn from that. I'm not sure where that precisely comes from, but
yeah, because I'm seeing how they're honest. All this business, like, well, maybe just degrees. I mean, that's the kind of thing that makes me wonder, because I'm definitely not a Muslim.
Yeah.
I have friends who are, and they're very nice, and but they're not like practice. They're kind of like their parents were.
Yeah, yeah, like a, yeah, like many lapsed Christians. Yeah,
yeah.
Can you comment on the role of women in Islam, or what your perception is of that, kind of versus the maybe more the media image?
Yeah. So this is tough because the role of women within Islam is going to be heavily shaped by the culture in which that particular woman is living. And so I would say that Islam as a faith does revere women highly. So many of the wives of Muhammad are kind of held up as being like mothers of the faith and important figures. But there is also, like in a lot of forms of Christianity, a strong strain of patriarchy that comes out of that culture in that time period, where men are held as the leaders in all aspects, home, religion, politics. And so it is going to vary. I would say that on the whole, women are not allowed the same sorts of, they're not allowed a lot of like religious leadership positions or family leadership positions, because there is there are roles that are defined within families that they think are God ordained. But as far as how a particular woman feels within that context, I think is going to be highly dependent on the woman, and then also the particular culture that Islam is taking shape. It might be very different here in the U.S. than it would be in Saudi Arabia, or it might be similar, just depending on the family.
The praying five times a day, that's not random, is it? Isn't it at certain times, sun up, sun down? Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what the five times are, but they're specified, are they not?
Yes, they are specified. So I'm not sure what the exact hours correlate to, but it is spread out fairly evenly throughout the day, those five times. Actually, the story goes that originally God wanted Muslims to pray far more often, and Muhammad said, no, they can't possibly pray that many times. Let them only pray five times. So we might think that that's a ton, but that was bargaining God down.
Respect and honesty and listening. In counseling, I have to listen more than I talk. And I think when we develop a friendship with anybody, not only Muslim, we need to know where they are and respect what they believe, and where you can, compliment them on their faith. And then when they will reciprocate, how are you religiously? And then you can say whatever you want to, and don't do it as a dogmatic statements. And then finally, you can say, how do we compare our religions, and who are strong people? You know, when they came back from the wars, and in Jerusalem, they killed a lot of Muslims and killed a lot of Jews. And a lot of those people have that in, why did they kill us in this place? And so forth. And they said, I would just simply say, they were protecting themselves, and as you protect yourselves. And they thought that that religion was a discourse for hate. And now we need to come together and have a discourse of love. Love one another. And see the power of what comparisons of what are. And if we can get into that kind of conversation, and after we've built up a friendship. I know in McDonald's there's a Muslim lady that works in there. And do you know, She is so sweet. And I tell her how sweet she is. And I told her I loved her one day. And she looked at me and she says, I love you too. Now that is a start. But she got another job and I don't know where she is.
Maybe I'll run into her one of these days.
Yeah.
Okay, I think I'm going to get one more and then wrap up.
I was going to make a comment because if you read the Old Testament about women's place, you see so much of what the Muslims believe and put on their women is exactly, very, very similar to what the Jewish population had for their women. The women have to be protected. The women can't go out by themselves. Mm-hmm. The women, and so we think of them as being putting down women. What they're doing is very similar to what the Old Testament, how women were dealt with, and a lot of the punishments that we see for what they say, you know, stoning people or killing people. It's in the Old Testament, too.
Yeah, all three of the Abrahamic faiths are, they grew up in that same cultural context, and so they share a lot of these cultural expectations, especially with gender roles and the family dynamics. So thank you so much for I want us to go ahead and I know the next group will be coming in. If you have questions, feel free to chat with me now. I'll throw my email address up on the board too if someone really emailing a question. But thank you so much for joining me. This was great.